The World of RPGs, Episode 27, The Netherlands. Welcome to The World of RPGs, a podcast in which we travel around the globe and learn about the local role-playing game scenes. I'm your host, Mo Bots, and in Episode 27, we are going to The Netherlands. There's not much on the news side. I was abroad and visited some game shops, and in one, the people even spoke the same language as in the Netherlands, but that will be for a different episode. And I ran a session of The Well at the local gaming club here in Istanbul, and I hope I can attend a convention this summer where we'll also run the adventure I tested there. Now, about the Netherlands. I've been there quite a lot as a kid and teenager, being from northwestern Germany, so in a border region. And about 10 years ago, I attended a summer school in Maastricht, though I didn't visit any game shops when I was there. The Netherlands, which means lowlands, has a population of about 18 million people. Most people in the country are non-religious, though traditionally the country has been Christian, split between Protestants and Roman Catholics. There are two confusions about the name of the country and their main language. The first one is that many people call the Netherlands Holland, and in some languages, that's even the official name for the country. But Holland is actually just one region of the Netherlands, so that's like calling the whole USA California. And the second confusion is about the name of the majority language, which in the local language is called Nederlands. And in other languages like German, you would say something like Netherlandish or Hollandish. But in English, for some weird historical reason, you say Dutch, which is confusing because that's very similar to Deutsch. But that's German for, well, German. So I will say Dutch, and my interviewees will say Dutch. But in the Dutch language and in most European languages, you do not say the word Dutch. And this confusion about Dutch and Deutsch is not totally off because both languages are continental Western Germanic languages. For example, I grew up in northwestern Germany in the state called Niedersachsen. And this Nieder is like the Nether from Netherlands because they're both lowlands. And when I recently visited Flanders, the Dutch-speaking region of Belgium, I could mostly read the signs. And if people were talking, I usually got the gist of it. And there was even one situation where I spoke German with a slightly northern accent to a German guy, and he thought I was speaking Dutch to him. So if you come from a language community with closely related neighbors, for example, you're from Poland and you hear Czech, or you're from Spain and you speak Catalan and you also understand Castilian, you will know what I mean. But please never confuse Dutch and the Germans. The histories of the countries are quite different. The culture and the language are connected, but not the same. There is another minority language in the Netherlands called Frisian, which is the closest relative to modern English. So, as usual, we begin the interviews with the GM from the actual play I used as a teaser in the last episode.
My name is Sky, and I'm the Dungeon Master from the Dutch-spoken D&D stream Dutch Dungeons. I mostly stream on Twitch. I'm currently 45 years old and only got into D&D about 6 years ago, when my wife was on a long holiday and I had all the time in the world. But I think my very first interaction with D&D has to be The Big Bang Theory. That's one of the series that they show live play of D&D in the episodes. That got me really curious about it. I like the concept of narrating and having a free improvising way of playing. And then I got a starter set for myself, asked my friends to play, and already took the role of the dungeon master on me. And we started just playing, just learning along the way. It's really fun to do.
And so is D&D available in Dutch?
No, I play my games in Dutch, but I translate everything. There are, of course, modules written by Dutch publishers, but the real official Wizard of the Coast D&D content is only in English. I mostly use online content, so that's very easy to throw it through Google Translate and then have like a Dutch version prepared before I play. So every session I prepare as a dungeon master, all the stuff that I need to narrate, at least, I will translate it into Dutch so that I have it ready to read in Dutch.
And speaking of languages, so are there any concepts or terms that are difficult to translate? For example, a monster name?
mostly it's like a mix of Dutch and English. So we still say advantage, disadvantage, because some stuff, if you translate it, it just sounds stupid. So we still say beholder and goblin, stuff like that. So it's mostly a mix, but it's the narrating and the role playing that we really keep in Dutch. But the game terms, for instance, are still English, at least in my table.
And are there any other games you've explored apart from D&D?
Yeah, I've tried a few things. D&D is really my main focus. But the fun thing is you have the D&D community Dutch 20. And on that platform, they also explore other TTRPGs. And there's always dungeon masters or game masters who offer a trial play where you can just sign up to do something. For instance, one time I played, what's it called again? Mjörgborg or something like that?
Mjörgborg.
Mjörgborg, yeah, that's the one. Yeah. That was really fun to do, and very high fatality rate, at least in that game. So I think in the evening that I played it, I went through like three characters. So it's really, you open the door, okay, there's a cannon behind it, you get blown to pieces, you die. So it's really fun to explore. But for me, Dungeons & Dragons is really my main thing. I am very interested in the new Daggerheart from the people from Critical Role, but I'm yet to dive into it.
And any original Dutch games?
I don't think there are really original Dutch games. I did play some Dutch written adventures from Dutch publishers. So sometimes for the stream, a Dutch publisher will reach out to me, like we wrote in one shot, can you promote it on your stream? And I always offer to live play it on the stream. That I have done, yeah.
Okay, I'll come back to that later, but let's talk about your stream. So what is that about? How did that come to be?
What I noticed when I started to look online for Dutch D&D content is that there was not a lot to find. So that for me was a motivation, at least, to stream in Dutch. When I first started, I streamed in English to make it more international. But when I chose to really commit to D&D content every week with cameras on real live play, I chose to do it really in Dutch. Mostly my motivation is two things. First, I talk good English. I think at least good enough to out myself. But to really express myself, Dutch is way bigger vocabulary to narrate, to describe things as a dungeon master. So I'm more comfortable in Dutch. And I always found it like a mission to keep making Dutch D&D content, because over the years, I've been doing it now for 6 years, D&D podcast, D&D streams, at least in the Dutch language, they come and they go. There's not a lot of them who keep at it. So I'm trying to be like the stable factor.
And do you play in any specific setting, or is it your own work?
No, I really always like to play in the Wizard of the Coast Faerun setting. So I like to play modules, pre-written adventures from Wizard of the Coast, which I then convert to Dutch. So for instance, at the moment we are playing Rime of the Frost Maiden, which in Dutch is IJs van het Vorstmeiske, and we tried to make it our own Dutch version, but we still follow, of course, the module only translated to Dutch. But I also did 3 years long a homebrew campaign that I wrote myself, The Nomads of Faerun, in Dutch, The Nomaden van Faerun, which was set in Faerun, but like 100 years before most of the stories. So I think most of the content is always in like 1480 DR, and we went like 100 years before that. And it was really fun to explore like all the Wikipedia that references to all the written books and the adventures and stuff that you only really read about and don't really have a play module about. So that's what was really fun to do.
And before that, you mentioned you also played a couple of local modules. Can you say a bit about them? And especially, do they include any Dutch cultural elements, or are they just set in the specific D&D world?
No, I've played several. There is one group, I think they're called the Mythmakers. That's a really nice group that makes D&D content based on Dutch myth and folklore. So when we played some one-shot of theirs on our stream, it was really based on a specific place in the province of Brabant at a certain castle that really exists. So that's fun to do. And we also played a one-shot once for a German publisher. The module was in English, but it was based on the golden age of, I think, Venice in Italy, which was also very fun to do. From that module, we really learned stuff about the Renaissance. That was really fun to do. To play, and while you play, you learn a little bit more about the Renaissance. It was nice. Only then with secret vampires that, of course, don't really exist in the Renaissance. But I always played around with wanting to do something in Amsterdam. I always like to have a setting where you can reference back to your own world. There's a Dutch podcast called Geen Woorden Maar Draken, and they have a really fun thing about it. So it's about a group that really starts in Pijnakker, which is a village near Den Haag, I think. And they get sucked into their D&D world through VR glasses. And at some point you forget they're still hooked up to like the Matrix, to some VR glasses. But they can always refer to the real world, because one was a Peugeot dealer and the other one was a teacher. So that's really a fun way to still play D&D, but also be able to reference cultural and pop cultural things of our real world. So they do nice content.
My stereotype would be that Dutch folklore would have a lot of references to the sea and have like ghosts on the sea, etc. I don't really have any background knowledge about it, so that's just my view of it.
Yeah, well, we have the, of course, I think the most Dutch myths you can find in the Efteling. So if you go to the, really the, how do you call the pret park, amusement park, the Efteling, there's a lot of Dutch folklore there, like the Bokkenriders and the Witte Wieve, which is like a witch ghost. So there's a lot of to be found there that you can base it on.
Something else I wanted to ask is how the local scene in the Netherlands work. So I guess you have game shops and conventions, just like in most other bigger countries. Can you maybe give a bit of details there? Or do you as a podcast also go to conventions?
What I noticed in the Netherlands is we're a small country and the culture was always, and the scene was always small, but it's really starting to grow more and more. So that now since a few years, we have two TTRPGs conventions that really about TTRPG. We're not talking about Comic-Con where there's like a little D&D corner, but it's really becoming more and more mainstream now. So it pops up everywhere. Of course, we have the game cafes where you can come over and play D&D. And lately you see more and more that it pops up like bigger events that are being organized in different cities, and that's really nice. The big TTRPG community in the Netherlands is Dutch 20. They have a Reddit that is very well visited. So if you're looking for a group, if you're looking for players, Reddit, their subreddit is really a nice place to hook up with other people and to get in connection with each other. And they have a Discord with like thousands of members on it. And there they organize not only D&D stuff, but Call of Cthulhu, Mausritter, you name it, the TTRPG, and they have an evening where you can play that and try it out. And they also go to conventions. Sometimes I go with them. And so they always try to be on different conventions that are suitable and offer real live D&D play. So there will be like 10 tables with 10 dungeon masters who will rotate for 1 or 2 days, depending on how long the convention is, to let people experience D&D and other TTRPGs. So they're giving a good effort to promote the hobby. It's really nice to do. And I always go there with my Rick and Morty D&D. So I will be dressed up like Rick Sanchez from the animated series Rick and Morty and do my Rick Morty D&D based gameplay, which is always very fun to do.
You said it's kind of a small scene, small country. How about other Dutch language countries? Are there connections to, for example, Belgium?
Of course, the Flanders part of Belgium is very good connected with the Dutch. The border of Belgium, of course, is not far away from us. So you can see that a lot of Belgians come to the Dutch D&D conventions and all the way around. So we have the Day of Dungeons, which is the Belgium D&D convention, where you also see, of course, see a lot of Dutch people there. And there's also a pretty big D&D community in Belgium. Yeah. We're all good friends. To anybody who's listening, try D&D. It's so fun. It's really a nice way to improvise, to hone your social skills, I would say, and do it in a fun way. I can recommend it to everybody.
Since Sky mentioned Dutch 20, let's find out more about them.
Well, my name is Cara. I am part of the Dutch 20 Foundation. I got into role-playing through school, basically. A lot of my classmates were nerds. We started talking during lunch. It started kind of with Magic the Gathering, and then some kind of went to fantasy, and then we started talking about LARP, and I went to a LARP, and then, hey, we also play D&D, and that's how I got into D&D.
And have you played other games than D&D?
I have played mostly one-shots of Vampire the Masquerade. I host one-shots of Candela Obscura, but mostly it's been Dungeons & Dragons.
Okay, quick question about Vampire the Masquerade. When you played that, where was it set?
It was set in the Netherlands, in Utrecht, current era. We played it in Utrecht mostly because everyone in the Netherlands knows Utrecht. Everyone knows about the Dom in Utrecht and has a picture in their head of the Dom in Utrecht, not necessarily for Amsterdam.
Can you tell me a bit about Dutch 20? What do you do there?
Dutch 20 is a foundation. Our goal is to make known and spread the joy of TTRPGs, tabletop role-playing games. So not just Dungeons & Dragons, but all of them. We are mostly active on Discord, where we host frequent freewheeler games that are Dungeons & Dragons. We have regular games in Pathfinder, and we have regular one-shots of different systems where GMs can just choose whatever they run. We post an agenda of that about every 2 months. We have seasons, as we call them. They run basically 2 months, and the GMs can sign up for weeks, and they can choose the day they want to host and the system they want to host.
So this is mostly online?
This is mostly online. We are also active real-life events, where we also host one-shots, where we try to have a mix of 50% Dungeons & Dragons and 50% other systems. Again, that is up to the GMs that sign up for it. Fests that we are active on are Anime Con, Spell and Spectacle, Castle Fest. Most recently was a Fantasy Fest that was in the beginning of February. The closest upcoming event that we will be hosting one-shots at is AnimeCon, which is in April.
So these would all be English games, or do you have any Dutch language games? The systems, I mean.
Mostly English systems. We are currently talking to a Dutch developer that has written their own things. I believe their rulebook is in English, though, because more people speak English than Dutch. But it's a new system and we haven't figured it out so far. And we also always leave it up to GMs whether they want to run certain systems or not. So it has to be in someone's wheelhouse and someone has to have the time to learn an entire new system. When it comes to the language we host in, we always leave it up to the GMs and the players at the table. Most people offer either Dutch or English, depending on the preference of the table.
So is the community also international or mostly confined to the Netherlands?
It is mostly confined to the Netherlands, but not everyone in the Netherlands speaks Dutch.
On the website, I also saw you have content, for example, articles or interviews. What kind of material do you have there?
We have a writer's team active. They try to make an article for the website every week. Sometimes it's a kind of a spotlight article for a specific TTRPG, a specific system. We have posts about the cons that we are at. So basically, hey, did you know we're standing here? It's next week. Come visit us. And always looking back at the event, if they can get it in time, they'll post the amount of players we had, the amount of sessions we played, stuff like that. Their overview articles, both on what we consider the best systems or that writer of 2025, or I believe we had like a looking forward to these systems. Daggerheart, for example, was one of those systems that was mentioned. We did an article on that. Well, these are systems you could be looking forward to. Sometimes there's themed articles. So in October, it's usually a bit horror or spooky themed. Everyone knows Call of Cthulhu usually, or Vampire the Masquerade, and there'll be shout-outs to other horror-themed systems that might not be as well-known, like Candela Obscura or Brindlewood Bay, things like that.
When you personally play outside of Discord, what would be the typical place to play? Is it at someone's home or in a cafe? How do you organize that?
I usually play at people's homes. I actually have three groups, one of which I DM. Two of those take place in my home, because I have one of the other session takes place at the other DM's home.
In East Asian countries, people usually have tiny homes and then they can't really host it at home. And so they use cafes, and then there are business models around it where you pay a cafe to host a session. And for example, in Germany, paying a GM is not very accepted. And in other countries, it's almost the norm, and it's kind of normal to have paid GMs. It sounds to me like that's a bit similar.
Yes, especially if people host in cafes or things like that. It's not very much like you have to pay the DM, but you have to pay your own fee so that everyone kind of has to share the cost of having that location available. And even when it's at someone's home, I usually make sure there are some drinks and some snacks. But sometimes you all order dinner together, and every once in a while, if they pay for my pizza, then I'm like, yes, that's very nice of you, because I make sure my home is available and I make sure there's drinks and coffee and tea and everything. So I very much appreciate if you sometimes pay for my pizza, basically. But that's more for common decency than that. That's a hard rule.
I'm usually the forever GM. And if I GM'd and people would pay me like money, like, I mean, 20 euros per person or so, I would also assume I would have to like give them the right value or something. And that would lead to a totally different style. But yeah, I've talked to people who do that as a living almost. And in some places, it's totally accepted.
I would feel the same way as if people were just like, here's 20 euros. Like, oh my God, I need to be really professional now and I need to do all the voices. I hate doing all the voices. I'm much more of a narrative role play style than I do not like that at all.
So how's your proportion of playing in Dutch and playing in English at the table?
It switches. Sometimes I find it easier to express myself in English, especially sometimes when it's more horror themed. There are just some words in English that sound so much better than they do in Dutch.
Can you give an example?
Yeah, so in English, there's the word squelch. And when you hear that word, you immediately get the feeling and you get this visceral reaction to it. I don't need to say anything more. I can just say squelch and everyone is like, yes. There's no word for that in Dutch. So I'd have to use multiple words to describe the same thing. So in those cases, I would describe the scene in English. I find role-playing for myself easier to flow when it's in English, but explaining things, especially system or rule-wise, sometimes goes easier in Dutch.
Yes, when I'm in Germany, sometimes we will speak like a pigeon and it will be German, but the game terms will be in English. And then the bad thing we do is we integrate them into German grammar.
Oh yeah, no, we usually don't do that.
Yeah, I would say ich habe gespellcasted. That would be like the perfect form of spellcasting, but in German.
It depends. I'm one of those people that I can switch mid-sentence languages, no problem. And I can switch back and forth. Some people find that very confusing and cannot do it. But in Dutch, we would say ik cast and then the name of the spell. So cast is not a Dutch word. We would just use the English term for it, basically.
Next, I talked to someone who experienced the early days of role-playing games in the Netherlands.
I'm Henk, and I've been playing role-playing games since 1979. I was at a members' meeting of the Dutch Science Fiction Association that I joined in 79, maybe a year earlier, but this was a meeting in 79, and there was one member who came there and he announced that he recently got in touch with a couple of people who were playing Dungeons and Dragons, and he thought that other people would be interested. Then that same year there was a convention, a big one in Rotterdam, and we had a lot of international writers, but that same group that that guy was part of was also playing there. And I found the room where they were playing, and one of the people had dropped out, and they said, well, do you want to take over this character? And I said, yeah, I don't know nothing, but I will join. We got a very linear scenario, basic dungeon crawl. But yeah, that got me hooked.
But then you didn't stay with D&D, did you?
I found another guy who actually had just left the school that I was on, and that guy had all of the books for AD&D, and we then started setting up regular sessions at his place, which was a bike ride and a train ride and a long walk, all at my place, and we basically got a small group together of four or five people, and we played at some different places. And that guy that who had the books would basically run most of the scenarios. That didn't last very long, but it was very enjoyable. Then 1 or 2 years later, by that time I was really hooked and I started looking for stuff. I got a collection of old White Dwarf magazines. One of the features of White Dwarf magazine was the column Rune Rites by Oliver Dickinson. Sometimes they would also post scenarios for different systems. So I learned that there was something like RuneQuest. And Oliver Dickinson wrote stories about RuneQuest. I don't know when he actually started writing his Griselda stories, but those gave me some insight in what the game could look like. It sounded more gritty than D&D, but there was something more. Then I found a copy, and that is the book I just showed you, the box set from Games Workshop. I purchased that, and after reading through that, it was really the mythology of Glorantha that got me hooked there. So, yeah, the D100 system or the D20 system, just basic rolling below your skill, that made intuitive sense. But what really got me hooked was that one line of text that metals are the bones of the gods. And that resonated with a personal story of mine because I had been struggling with religion and spirituality. And I had gradually drifted away from organized religion. But I was still looking for something to fill that spot of spirituality, because I understood that the way that people are built, the stuff in your mind that will trigger with really strong stories. And that's really what the world of Glorantha would do for me.
There's maybe one thing I have to explain for the listeners if they're confused about two things. You mentioned White Dwarf and Games Workshop. So in the 1980s, it's important to know that Games Workshop was the importer of many American games into Britain and then for the European market.
Early 80s, there were two magazines and two companies. We had Games Workshop in the UK. We had TSR in the US. The funny thing is that early 80s, White Dwarf was catering for all kinds of systems. They would do anything, everything, and White Dwarf would support that. Dragon was the magazine for TSR, and that was purely dedicated to D&D. The funny thing that you see throughout the 80s, you saw White Dwarf, Games Workshop, and Citadel shifting all the way to being just one company with one set of products and only promoting those products. And yeah, White Dwarf stopped being a generic gaming magazine and became just a company catalog, more or less. Famously, when the office for White Dwarf was moved over to Nottingham from London, the original cast of the magazine arranged all of the articles and the index of that final issue that they produced to make the first letter of each thing send a message to the then CEO. It basically said, sod off, Brian Ansel.
What was the role-playing scene like in the Netherlands in the 80s?
It was very scattered, and I tried to come up with my own RuneQuest campaign, but I was very insecure. It was very hard for me to organize that. But I knew different people were playing different games. There was a small group in Utrecht, but for me that was quite remote. I had a couple of people I knew in Delft because I had studied there. And I got together with a small group and we had one or two sessions there where I played RuneQuest. I did similar things with another group with science fiction friends in The Hague, but I had limited funds and I was not able to find a lot of people to play these games. I did know that people were doing games. There was a quite strong zine culture that basically surrounded the concept of fictional worlds. People would pretend they were the rulers of a country, and then they would declare war with someone else, and they would write their own stories. But as soon as you entered other people's territory, you basically had to let them complete the narrative.
That's actually how role-playing was first started in Germany before contact to the US scene.
Yeah, well, because it was already a kind of role-playing, but at a very slow pace. Similarly, that same culture combined these fictional worlds and diplomacy. And in some cases, they would even have a diplomacy campaign and then people writing their own stories around that. But there were a couple of people. The small group that I collected around my place of living, south of Rotterdam, we had one guy who had also created his own fantasy world. He was not playing any game in there, but that was his hobby. And there were other people in the early 80s who published stories about their fictional worlds. And these were not adventure stories or anything. No, these were chronicles. This was the history of a world, of a country with fictional languages. Some people came up with their own languages, similar to what Tolkien did.
And were there any games translated into Dutch in the 80s?
Yes, there were. I've originally found one game which was translated from German. It was translated as Het Oog des Meesters, and it was a translation of the German game Das Schwarze Auge. And it felt very D&D-like, more or less like basic D&D. I remember very little. I still have my own write-up of the review. I basically got granted a copy from my local bookshop because I just went in the bookshop and it was just there, and the people in the bookshop didn't even know what to do with it. And I could explain that, but it's hard to explain if you can't just show it. And then I was a member of DucoSim. In early 80s, mid 80s, I was also a member of the Het Bestuur, the committee. I took on the topics of fantasy board games, card games, and role-playing games. I always made sure that we split that one is a theme and one is a type of game. Science fiction or fantasy, that's the background, that's the setting. And I always made sure that we made that distinction. Role-playing games are typically, D&D is typically a fantasy role-playing, but yeah, we had many other games. We had Traveller. Then one other guy in the association who was chairman for a while, and I don't know if this was before or after, he was also contacted by a publisher to help produce a Dutch translation of basic D&D. And that was produced, but then, yeah, by that time, all of the Dutch people who were really into, already got into the game, already used the English books. And nobody ever really bothered investing in Dutch materials. I think it's similar to the Scandinavian market, but I know that Finland and Sweden, I believe they have their own translations of Call of Cthulhu. But yeah, those are countries where fantasy role-playing is very popular. But in the Netherlands, translations never took off. I knew this already from the science fiction market. A good print run for a science fiction book would be 1,000 copies. And you would be happy if you sold that. Only the best of the best would get reprinted. Most people, if you have English originals, after the, I think, in the 80s or 90s, English was already established as a topic at grammar school or basic education. So when you're in grade 8 or 10 or so, you would already have a bit of English in your curriculum. And it's, of course, also, of course, Dutch television has always had subtitles, so you would always hear the original text. And that is important compared to Germany, where all TV shows are dubbed. That isolates you from the original language. And in the Netherlands, the market for TV shows was just too small to maintain a large cast of voice actors. And that works through. And in the 80s and 90s, I also got in touch with some people. We had some science fiction conventions. I collaborated on a convention in 1983 where I also introduced role-playing. I ran my own role-playing sessions in 1985 at a different convention. And basically, that's always been my way of playing role-playing games. I never had extended campaigns. I basically either lead or play in one-off episodes at conventions.
And then would you run the games in English or in Dutch?
Depending on the audience. In the Netherlands, the science fiction conventions were quite open. We always had some people from the UK or from Germany or from Belgium. If it was just all Dutch-speaking people, I would do it in Dutch. If there was one English person, I would just switch over to English. And that is typically what I see whenever I come to an international convention. I go to conventions in Germany quite often, 2 times or 3 times a year. Yeah, it's the same there. Sometimes there are games that are purely German, but most of the time these conventions have an international audience and they play in English.
Yeah, and that's actually how we met. I think we didn't play together, but we talked a bit last year at the Kraken. And speaking of Kraken, so concerning Chaosium games, you mentioned RuneQuest quite a lot, but what about Call of Cthulhu? Do you play that too?
I have played that occasionally. I've always admired the game and the mythos. I'm not a big fan of Call of Cthulhu, but occasionally I can join. My big mistake, my big flaw when I play Call of Cthulhu is that I try to make my characters to behave rational. So if there's the slightest sign of danger, my characters will run away. This reminds me of a Dutch author, Thomas Alderheuvel. He has written a couple of thrillers. And one of them was, I believe it's the title was Hex, which in Dutch was situated in a small town on the coast. And then he basically worked with a translator, but they reworked the entire story and resituated the entire story into the US. It was the original author and he had a big hand in the actual translation. Basically, he translated it himself, rewrote it himself with an American translator as his editor. But that is really a horror or thriller story, and that could probably be well adapted to Call of Cthulhu. In the 80s, I had my own ideas about scenarios in the Netherlands with a lot of water, a lot of swamps. But that never came to anything. I think I have played in a couple of games with Dutch game masters, one or two games that were actually situated in the Netherlands.
So you talk mostly about developments in the 80s. Are there any things from the 90s you want to comment on from the gaming scene?
I do remember that when we had a World Science Fiction Convention in 1990 in The Hague. And then afterwards, we got together with a couple of people who were into the SCA. So we once gathered together in the neighborhood of Eindhoven at an Iron Age open air museum, an Iron Age reconstruction. And we basically had a small SEA meeting there. No battles, but more a bit of live role play. One of the people from the King of Germany, or what it's called in the SEA community, holding court and allowing people to petition for certain requests. That's where I met one guy who I already knew from DukoSim, Louis Golkman. He's one of the guys really into Pendragon. Through him, I also found, or through DukoSim, I also found another group of people who were playing RuneQuest in their own way. They introduced me to Bahrach and the Tentacles convention that was arranged there. And I then started going there from 1995.
Just to make it clear, those are conventions in Germany, not in the Netherlands.
Yes, that was in Germany. But that basically gave me a new boost. By that time, I had, in 1993, I had started my own RuneQuest daily mailing list, which was not targeted towards the Netherlands, but was really international. It ran for a year and a half, and it was just around the time of the RuneQuest Renaissance. And that was more or less a trigger for me going to the conventions in Germany. And I've been connected with that community ever since. And through that, I met more people in the Netherlands. One interesting area in the Netherlands would be the Dutch game shops in Utrecht. Around Oudegracht, that's a major central area with a lot of shops in a unique location. You get these two-level buildings where at the street level you have the shop, and then you can go down into the cellar, and they have a cellar that comes out onto the quay for the canal that runs straight through town. And there's three or four different game stores there. They all cater for different things, but there's subcultures, the Joker, Never Neverland. I think there's at least one more. And many of those started in the 90s. Subcultures started early this century, I think, and they evolved over time. Subculture got started in one of those cellars with a lot of LARP stuff. We have had a lot of Renaissance fairs like Castle Fest and Elf Fantasy Fair. Those are places where people gather, they can dress up. It's a different part of the culture, but there's a lot of overlap. It's comparable in popularity to the Comic-Con, which also happens, of course, where in Utrecht we have a really large Comic-Con event that occurs yearly and people dress up.
And finally, let's find out more about the first RPG created in the Netherlands.
My name is Frank Rieter, and I'm from the Netherlands, obviously. The first role-playing game I played was the Dutch role-playing game Kweeste. I think it was about 1988. I was in high school. A couple of friends of mine from my own class already played it and introduced me to it. So that went very natural. I was always interested in anything creative. I played theater in school theater, things like that. So when they told me about the game, I was immediately interested. I thought, oh, that could be fun. And it was. And that was my first steps. And in the Netherlands, there were a couple of shops that sold role-playing games at the time. I think that was in the year after I started playing Kweeste. And that got me introduced to all different kind of role-playing games from America and England. Of course, Dungeons & Dragons, but especially Call of Cthulhu, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, things like that. So especially during high school years and during my student years, I think I played more role-playing games than I actually studied. And the hobbies, it sticked. So I'm still playing with a couple of friends on a regular basis. We are 30 years later. Yeah. Of course, I do a couple of things next to playing role-playing games. I'm a writer. That was always my main profession. But of course, writing, it's not always easy to earn your bread and butter with it. So I'm also a manager within an IT company. That's a steady income. And next to that, I try to spend as much time as possible on the creative side.
Now, you mentioned two games where I want to ask something. First of all, Call of Cthulhu, if you play that, where is that set? In New England or in the Netherlands?
I always played the third edition and later the fourth edition. And Call of Cthulhu, it is, of course, based on the universe created by Howard Phillips Lovecraft. It is originally set in New England, in America, in the 1920s and 1930s. But from there, there are lots of modules and expansion sets that place it in different times and different eras. I always played in the 1920s, 1930s, and also in England, and some world-spanning campaigns. The original story, The Call of Cthulhu, is also a global and cosmic horror story, so that, of course, some adventures will lead you to Egypt and to the Far East and, all over the place. So what I always think that was nice was that it is both a historical piece and a fantasy horror piece, so there are two sides to it. It is a bit of historical role-playing with a lot of fantasy and horror and fantastic elements. I wrote a couple of stories myself that are set in the Netherlands, both in the 1920s, 1930s, and one in the 1950s. But those are only stories I wrote. I never managed a campaign during those years. But it would be easy to adapt it to the Dutch city of Leiden, where you can venture into the Egyptian Museum and discover some secret clues within the Leiden papyri that are exhibited there. That would be an easy transfer.
And then you mentioned Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, of which I'm also a huge fan. So there's this city and there's a source book for Marienburg that is supposed to be the Netherlands, I would guess. So how does that come across for a Dutch player?
I think that for a Dutch player, most names and references feel more German than Dutch. And I played the Enemy Within campaign, Death on the Reich, Something Rotten in Kislev. Those are a couple of very brilliant stories. And that went rather well because it felt very European, whereas the classic Dungeons & Dragons has although they try to gain inspiration from fairy tales and things like that, it always feels a little bit American plastic. And I think that Warhammer Fantasy role-playing hits the note very well on the European side, where you feel grounded in a fantasy version of medieval Germany or Holland or France. So that really appeals.
But you mentioned your first step into role-playing games was a Dutch game called Quest. Can you talk a bit more about that game? What is that like?
Yeah, Quest was created by a Dutchman, Joop Oele. He passed away last year, unfortunately, else you could have invited him to talk about it. And he created Quest on his own and more or less uninfluenced by other role-playing games. And I think that's quite special because a lot of role-playing developers, they already know what is there. If you start writing a role-playing game now, you know about the large titles, especially Dungeons & Dragons and also a lot of other. And even back then, if you started to doing that in the 90s or in the 80s, you knew about Dungeons & Dragons, but also Call of Cthulhu, RuneQuest, the D6 system, and things like that. And Joop wasn't aware of any of that back in, I think, 1979. And even a little bit earlier, he started experimenting with two things. On one hand, he was very into New Age, and he knew about guided fantasy and guided imagery. So that is more like guided meditation. You tell a story and you take people along. They sometimes close their eyes and they lay on the ground and they just are overwhelmed or are guided by the storyteller into those stories. And Joop understood the potential of that mechanism, where he sometimes asked questions or wanted some feedback and input for the stories, and then he started improvising. So that was really role-playing at its core without the usual gaming elements. It was a cooperative storytelling. That was one of his major inspiration parts. And on the other hand, he was also a gamer. He played Go and he created board games himself. And he was a graphic artist, so he liked to make illustration to it. And one thing led to another, and he started to combine these two or three elements together, where he created a game where he thought, okay, we have this guided fantasy, this interactive storytelling, everybody gets a role and we add some gaming elements to it, where I hand out pictures of where you are. That was the graphic element. And then we have a little system with statistics and a die and some coin flips. And we create a game around it to decide whether things will happen or not. And when he combined that, maybe he had heard of Dungeons & Dragons, but he never owned a copy. I know that for sure. So when he published Quaist, he published it in 1980 in a box version. You can see that it is a role-playing game like we all know them now. But also there is a certain look and feel to it that is really different because he invented it on his own without real direct inspiration from other role-playing games.
Can you say something about the setting?
Yes, it is a fantasy setting. And I think that you could describe it as a bit low fantasy. There is, of course, magic, and there are magical creatures. It feels European in name giving and the whole vibe. And there are some guilds that you can play. You choose to become a mage or a temple knight or some other, but there is no option to play another creature. And I think that is because of his background in guided fantasy. It is real portal fantasy. He always tried to make the game in a way that when you start out in the game, it is very close to yourself. You don't have to create a whole character with a background in the world. You don't have to know anything. When you start out, you know nothing. You just have your own mind and your own creativity. And the character building is very slowly when you play the game. Of course, that influences the setting of the world. You discover the world, but it is a typical fantasy world. But very player focused and very interaction focused. Yeah.
So what was the publication history? You said it came out in 80, and then were there supplements?
I think that Joop underestimated how much work it would be to do follow-up stories because he started out with a box and the box had only one story and a rule book and some coins you could flip on the dice and a lot of illustrations. And that was it. And then he started a magazine, Quaist magazine. And in this magazine, he published some background and new stories and some more information about the guilds that you had, the career paths that you could choose. And he published, I think, all in all, 6 or 7 installments over 2 years. But it was a social success, but not a commercial success. And he couldn't keep up with the demand. So when there was a group and you started playing, you want to continue playing. But he wasn't finished yet making the illustrations. So most game masters would probably produce material themselves with the group they were playing it with. And Joop lost, well, not interest, but a bit of grip on the publishing process. And after 2 or 3 years, he just left it as it was. More or less unfinished, because he started writing a campaign where you, of course, fight against the forces of evil in the world, but that campaign wasn't finished. It was finished for his group in notes and raw drafts, but it wasn't published. So I think that after 2 or 3 years, he stopped publishing further installments. Quaist still had a small fan base in the Netherlands. Groups kept playing it. They copied, just went to the copy shop and copied the materials and added their own ending to the campaign that Joop created. And I think then it became more or less silent on the publishing side for about 10 years. It was early 90s that within the group that I was playing with, there was one player, Erik Nuiten, and he played with Joop. He knew Joop and he copied all the original stories from Joop, even the ones that weren't published. So those were available to me and to the group I was playing in. And also he initiated the idea of republishing Quaist, not with a commercial goal in mind, but well, to preserve all the materials and to make it available for the public. And I joined that project. We did it with the three of us, Erik, Carlo, and me. And the only thing that we tried to do is preserve the materials, be sure that also for the last few unpublished stories, there were enough illustrations in the original style that Joop had in mind. And we published it very low key for anyone who was interested on a low budget way. And a couple of years after that, I think that project took us 5 or 6 years to finish. And after that, well, I felt a bit responsible because then we had that material. It was published on paper initially. And a couple of years after that, I converted all publications to PDF and made them available on the internet. And they still are. If you look up Quaist on Wikipedia, one of the links on the site will lead to my website. And there you can just enter your email address and we will send you the files, just a zip file of all the PDFs that are available for Quaist. based. That is the way it still is. And there are still groups going on. I think that is still amazing for a very low-key and unpublished niche role-playing game that in a year, still a couple of 10 or 20 people find my website, download the stuff, and sometimes they report back, okay, I started a group, or, oh, I could finally continue with my group with the original stories and things like that. That is, I think, the publishing history in a nutshell.
Yes, and that's also how I found you via the Wikipedia entry, because I had heard from the game from a Dutch fellow player with whom I've played during the pandemic online, although we did live in the same German city at the time, and he had mentioned it, so it was like on my radar. And then I searched Wikipedia, the Dutch language Wikipedia for role-playing games, and it seemed to be the only original RPG from the Netherlands, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that is the only one that was published and distributed in shops, sometimes game shop or related shops. I think that there are a couple of more systems, but they will probably not be published professionally. So if you ask around, and I think that goes for many countries, there's always some guy who made his own system and his own setting and his own world. I think that's a very common hobby, probably all over the world. Let me add one more thing, because one of your questions was, of course, what makes Kveest different than other games? And I think that there is one thing that is interesting to tell, and that is that are the way the guilds are set up and the way they approached storytelling. Because the guilds made by Kveest, they are designed in a way that really challenge the player to be creative with them. I think the best example is the magic system. You do not get spells, but you only get words. And you have to use a specific grammar to weave the spells yourself. And then it is up to the game master to decide if you did that correctly and if the intended effect will be there. And if not, the spell will fail. So you have to be in an imaginary language. You'll have to create sentences yourself to have an impact on the world. You can compare it a little bit with how Ursula Le Guin created her Earthsea magic, where you have to know the true words or things to have an impact on it. And the same goes for the druidic system, where you get a lot of plants, touch tools, and things like that, herb, and they have a specific effect. But when you start mixing them, they have a different impact and a different outcome, a bit like we nowadays know from some computer games, where you have a lot of ingredients and you can match them together with sometimes unpredicted outcomes. But I think that back in the 1980s, and maybe still, there is no real role-playing counterpart. Most of the times you get recipes and that's it. You have just a specific thing, and the effect of the largeness of that effect depends on a dice roll. And there is no real creativity involved for the player to start matching things and have unpredicted outcomes and be creative with what the game hands you. And I think that is typical for Kveest, that the creativity that comes from the players is very important in storytelling. I think that's a nice thing to add. And one other last thing that I would like to mention is the storytelling. There is this typical, both in computer games and in tabletop games, effect where, well, evil just sits waiting until the players come around to defeat it. You have this city or this evil castle, you go there, you beat a bad guy, and that's it. And for interactive storytelling, it becomes much more interesting if evil has an agenda throughout the world, and as a game master, you are able to tell that story or give the players a sense of danger throughout little hints and little incidents. And from all these incidents, there starts a larger story emerges. And I think that Kveest was one of the first games that really had that, where you could feel, oh, this is not only a standalone story with one bad guy, we beat him and that's it. No, you felt this is a living world. All these stories are connected. And there are also some stories that if you do not act, it will end in tragedy. So it will unfold itself. There is this history going on, this large-scale history around a city or around a country. And you can impact them as players, but the incidents and the storytelling and all the installments in that story, they will continue, even if as players you will not act. And that makes it more impactful. All these computer games that promise meaningful choices or meaningful impact into the world, often they don't have that. They promise it, but they don't actually deliver. But Kveest delivered on that front very early on in history. And I think that is one of the reasons that it had so much appeal and that I became addicted to it.
So how would you think would be the impact for role-playing culture of Quaestor in the Netherlands?
I find it hard to assess because it is quite small scale. And the Netherlands isn't a big country, of course, but Joop publishes books. I do not even know how many he made, but maybe a couple of hundred, maybe a thousand, but not more than that. I think he sold them all over the years. So all over the Netherlands, there were groups and they sometimes survived very long. People sometimes play 1 or 2 years, 3 years, and then it's over. But I know of a couple of surviving groups that have played for 20 or 25 years. So is there a lot of impact? No, but there is a very dedicated, long-standing niche that always pops up and that you will always encounter when you start asking around about role-playing games in the Netherlands. And maybe especially in the beginning years, it helped gain interest. There were more systems coming from outside the Netherlands, that there was a sort of fan base that people recognized. Oh, hey, there is a Dutch product that is alike. Maybe it made it in a way easier, but I'm not sure about that.
So for Dutch language games or translations, I heard that there was D&D translated in the 80s and then the German game, Das Schwarze Auge.
Yeah, I think the Schwarze Auge was very popular in the late 80s, early 90s. Dungeons & Dragons, the Dutch translation, was not received well. It was translated, but only the first red box. Well, I'm not sure if this is a typical Dutch thing. It will go for more languages. But when you start translating fantasy, it feels different. Even if it is translated brilliantly, people who already know the original will always think that it is a bit off. And if you don't translate it all at once, people will be confronted with a part that is translated, and if they want to continue playing, they need to reach out for the original language material if they have, and because in the Netherlands most people do read and write English, they will probably have then a mix of Dutch and English material, and they won't like that. So I think that part of the failure of the Dutch translation of D&D is that they brought only one box and no follow-up materials at the same time, and that they reached out to a group of people who already knew the English material. And I think that is typical for the Netherlands, also for the fantasy books. A lot of fantasy books that fail in their translation, not because the translation is bad, but because the hardcore fans, the initial readers, they already know the English part, so they don't really like or need the Dutch translation. And then they start translating the first installment of a 7-part series, and people always read faster than they publish. So I think that the only Dutch publisher that did a good job doing that was a Dutch publisher who decided to translate everything that Neil Gaiman wrote. He dumped it on the Dutch market just in one go. I think 50 books at that time. It was, I think, 10 years back. And that philosophy behind that was, okay, if you do it, then you should do it all at once so that people can continue reading. And the same goes for Terry Pratchett. There's also is very brilliantly translated into Dutch, but there's one dedicated translator who was the driving force behind that. And he said, I will translate it all and I will translate it as soon as they come out, because that is the only way that we can service the people and give them immediately the Dutch look and feel, the Dutch counterpart of these novels. But that's more about books than about role-playing games.
So thank you for listening to episode 27 of The World of RPGs. The intro music was Battle of the Dragons by Thomas Mutsu and the logos by Iber Karakas. A special thanks goes out to all my interviewees from the Netherlands that helped bring this together. And thanks also to Frederick, with whom I've played online a lot, for giving me some initial information about the country's gaming scene. As always, you can find relevant links, for example, to conventions and shops mentioned in the show notes. Please follow and like this podcast on your player or social media of choice. And now let's brace for one of the largest non-English role-playing scenes. And with non-English, I don't only mean that they translate almost everything there is, but they have a huge amount of own games. Voilà.
Quoi qu'il en soit, il n'y aura pas de leçon aujourd'hui. Vous serez libre sur le reste de l'après-midi. Vous pourrez profiter du dernier jour de festival d'Ismer Korma. Et je vous souhaite bonne chance. Rendez-vous au pied des montagnes demain matin, à l'entrée de l'épreuve.
Oui, oui, d'accord.
Vous ressortez dans les rues. La fête bat son plein. Partout. Il y a de la musique. Il y a des étals de nourriture, des étals de vêtements, il y a même des étals qui vendent des accessoires, des masques, des chapeaux, etc. Il y a énormément de gens en ville. Ça grouille. Et vous savez que ce festival, en fait, ce qui est aussi important, c'est qu'il y a beaucoup de, il y a beaucoup d'étrangers qui viennent pour vendre leurs marchandises, etc. C'est vraiment un très gros festival printanier dans la région qui draine sur des centaines de kilomètres les gens, les marchands, etc. Et là, c'est vraiment, quand vous sortez, vous êtes en train de discuter. Vous retrouvez au milieu d'une foule de gens, tous plus grands que vous, qui vous bouscule un peu à droite, à gauche.
Il y a beaucoup de monde.
Ah ouais.
Moi, je prends une petite pomme sur un étalage, comme ça, mine de rien, et puis je la croque et je fais « Je suis pas inquiète. »
Fais-moi un jet d'escamotage, s'il te plaît. Mine de rien.
Escamotage, attends. 16.
Est-ce que je peux faire un jeu de détection ?
Un jeu de perception ?
Perception, pardon, de ce qui s'est
passé. Pour voir ce qu'elle fait ?
Pour savoir si je l'ai vu en...
Ouais, ok, bien sûr, ouais, bien sûr. Il faut que tu fasses plus de 16. 16 ou plus.
17 au dé, je crois.
Oui.
17 au dé.
Donc tu la vois... En fait, tu la vois tendre la main vers une pomme, commencer à prendre une pomme, et toi, tu sens sur ta main...
Non.
Le marchand qui, de l'étal qui te regarde.
Et
jeune fille.
Et j'arrive vers le marchand. Non, non, mais si, c'était bon. Et je tends une pièce de cuivre.
Allez.
Elle avait prévu de payer.
Mm-hmm. Et il te balance la pomme.